Greetings, constant listeners. Welcome to mid-September installment of The Far Middle. Nick Deolia speaking to you. And yesterday was Constitution Day, so I'm going to ask, did you celebrate? Now, I am being a bit facetious, but thinking about it, we should celebrate because that single document, it has done more good for more people than any other document I can think of. We have a lot to cover on episode, 174. So let's get right into it with our sports dedication. And boy, doesn't it seem like every week we've got so much to cover, which is a good problem to have for a podcast like this. Now, the premiere date is September 18th. In 1994, on September 18th, something premiered what I believe to be the greatest sports documentary in the history of sports documentaries. And it premiered on PBS. It was done by Ken Burns. It was narrated by the national news anchor, John Chancellor. And it had 9 glorious episodes or installments, or what they called for this documentary, innings. Yes, I am talking about the documentary Baseball by Ken Burns, which he did after his even better documentary, as if that was possible, but it was in this case, with the Civil War. And the Baseball documentary, an experience viewing it. I love Ken Burns' work with the Civil War, Baseball, his other efforts. And the only thing I would change is sort of adding more detail, an extra inning, so to speak, to split the 1970s, that decade, into its own inning. The 9th inning of the documentary covers the period from 1970 to 1992. That's just too much going on over those 22 years to fit within one inning, especially the 1970s. Now, the actors are celebrities outside of baseball who do voiceovers in this documentary to speak or play the role of long-deceased legends. It's impressive, adds a really cool element to the viewing experience. You've got everybody from Paul Newman to Ed Harris, Gregory Peck, Jason Robards, and even, believe it or not, Anthony Hopkins, some of the cast of voiceover actors and characters that appear on the documentary. And those interviewed outside of baseball, you know, talking about their ties to the game, it's awesome. It's an awesome list. And of course, the players, those legends, there's too many to list here that show up in the Ken Burns work. The only annoying thing to me about that documentary is all those New York City celebs, you know, beating their chests about how New York in the 1950s, it was just the capital of baseball. Yes, we know Billy Crystal, we know. Nevertheless, Baseball, it's my top-ranked sports doc of all time, and we dedicate episode 174 of This Far Middle to it. Let's dedicate a significant portion of this episode to a sequence of events that are right out of a spy novel or suspense movie that deserve a documentary soon of its own. Now, maybe Ken Burns is available, I'm not sure, but this looks more and more as if it actually happened in real life. And it's both fascinating and frightening, very relevant to America today. Much of what I will summarize borrows heavily from an excellent piece published in the Wall Street Journal by Rohan Panjevsky. And there is so much speculation out there as to what actually happened that I want to emphasize at the start, this is my best assessment and what I consider to be the most accurate views that have been reported that are out there. Only the perpetrators and the actors know for sure as to what actually unfolded. And I've read a lot on this. I've heard about every imaginable variation of views or sort of hypotheticals. And I think that what we're about to discuss represents the most likely reality. The topic, and I hope you're intrigued by what it might be that leads up to this at this point in time, but the topic is the sabotage, the blowing up of the Nord Stream natural gas pipeline under the Baltic Sea in Europe. That pipeline is the controversial one that Germany worked with Russia to establish. They created Western European energy dependency on Russia, and then in turn, that emboldened Russia to use that energy leverage to invade the Ukraine. It's 700 miles long, the Nord Stream, and it sits more than 250 feet below the surface of the sea. As to why and how the pipeline was blown up is a story that you have to hear. It's, again, one that's fascinating and one that has major geopolitical repercussions. And it all started in a Ukrainian bar, of all places, just over 2 years ago with patrons who met and ended up proposing something crazy after drinking quite a bit. In May of 2022, Ukrainian military officers and businessmen, they were celebrating the halting of the Russian invasion. Ukraine, of course, shocked the world, including your host, with its scrappy and effective defense. And at some point, one of the celebrants in the bar thought of an idea, destroying the Nord Stream pipe to hobble Russia's economic engine of energy exports, and to remove an impediment, frankly, to European support for Ukraine in the form, again, of the energy insecurity and dependency on Russia that I spoke about. About 4 months later, in late September 2022, after that drinking session in the bar, seismologists, they recorded what looked like an underwater earthquake near a Danish island in the Baltic Sea. And the seismic signature was from three huge explosions on the Nord Stream pipeline under the sea. The ripping apart of the pipe spewed natural gas from the seabed to a bubbling mass on the surface, and it represented, get this, the largest ever recorded release of natural gas, equivalent to the annual CO2 emissions of Denmark as a nation. It is a huge pipeline, as I said. Now, the attack, or sabotage, it exacerbated an already painful energy crisis in Europe, and such an act would and should be considered, frankly, an act of war under international law. It was a huge deal with major geopolitical, military, and economic repercussions. But who did it? Theories are all over the internet. They're found all over the media. I read it was President Biden at one point and our CIA. Some said Putin himself did it. Probably the same people who said Putin aided President Trump and interfered in the election, which of course was, well, let's say hogwash to keep this PG. But everyone speculated all over the game board of possibilities. But now it's becoming clearer as to who did it and how it happened. It involved a small rented yacht with a six-member crew, including trained divers, and it looks like at least one of the members was a woman helping with the cover of looking like this was nothing more than a group of friends or couples on a pleasure cruise. But the men and women on this mission that were on that yacht were looking at deadly serious business. Now, a Ukrainian military officer who said that he was involved in the event, he went on record stating, quote, "I always laugh when I read media speculation about some huge operation involving secret services, submarines, drones, and satellites. The whole thing was born out of a night of heavy boozing and the iron determination of a handful of people who had the guts to risk their lives for their country." End quote. Ukrainian President Zelensky, he initially approved the plan, which is a huge issue, of course, and carries ramifications for Ukraine. But supposedly later, when the U.S. intelligence services learned of it, we asked the Ukrainian president to pull the plug on the operation, so Zelensky allegedly ordered a halt. Now, why do we order a halt? The United States. So odd to see our leaders attack our domestic natural gas industry on one hand, and then turn around and work to protect Russia's natural gas industry on the other hand. That's a strange thing to see, is it not? And do you really think that President Zelensky in the Ukraine ordered a stop to the effort? Or did he do that sort of in the form or hollow manner to be able to claim deniability later? It's another good question. But apparently, Ukraine's top military commander, that's General Zelensky, he led the effort and ignored the supposed order from the president of the Ukraine and greenlighted the operation. And the general viewed the pipeline as a legitimate target in Ukraine's war against Russia. After all this happened, the Germans were, let's say, upset. That's probably putting it mildly. Their pipeline, their feed of natural gas was blown up, destroyed. That created a massive problem for the German economy. Germany investigated the incident and found email, phone, fingerprint, and DNA evidence that points to this alleged sabotage team. Now, General Zelensky of the Ukraine is now the ambassador to the United Kingdom. And he said he knows nothing of any such operation, and the idea is a, what he called, mere provocation. He says Ukraine armed forces weren't authorized to conduct overseas missions, and he therefore wouldn't have been involved. He basically denies it. Ukrainian intelligence also denies involvement and said that President Zelensky, and this is using their words, did not approve the implementation of any such actions on the territory of third countries and did not issue relevant orders. Now, Putin is upset, as you can imagine, like Germany is. He blamed the United States, and Russia has said the German investigation pointing to Ukraine were, this is using again the terms coming out of Russia, fairy tales worthy of the Brothers Grimm. Probably because Russia doesn't want to appear weak or exposed to Ukrainian aggression when it comes to its vital infrastructure like pipelines. It's bad optics, of course, for Putin. Germany issued an arrest warrant for a Ukrainian professional diving instructor for his alleged involvement in the situation and aftermath harmed relations between Kiev and Berlin. And ironically, the only nation providing more support to Ukraine than Germany is the United States. So Ukraine, if it performed the sabotage, was biting in some ways the hand that feeds it. And there's also the issue of NATO and its doctrines. Germany, of course, is a member of NATO. Ukraine is not, at least not yet. And this was an attack on a NATO member, which triggers NATO protocols. Germany acknowledged the dilemma by saying, quote, "An attack of this scale is a sufficient reason to trigger the collective defense clause of NATO, but our critical infrastructure was blown up by a country that we support with massive weapons shipments and billions in cash." That's a great way of summarizing how you're sitting between the horns of a dilemma. The details of the alleged sabotage are quite intriguing. The leaders of the operation, they agreed that the businessmen would finance the project because the army was already broke. A military officer would oversee the mission, and one participant described the effort as a public-private partnership, which isn't how most of us would think of that term, public-private partnership, when we hear it. The military overseer was to report directly to the four-star general, General Zelensky, and within days, President Zelensky approved the plan. There's no paper trail of this, only secret sources and third-party reporting to go off of. But intelligence services across Europe, they know what they're doing, and they are good at monitoring. And soon enough, Dutch intelligence learned of the plot. Dutch intelligence warned the CIA. The CIA then warned Germany. And we, the United States, told Zelensky to stop the operation. Now, whether he said stop and the general ignored him, or whether Zelensky really wanted the operation to proceed, or maybe a combination of the two, we don't really know, as I said earlier, for sure. Zelensky allegedly took his general to task, but the general shrugged off the criticism. Apparently, General Zelensky told President Zelensky that the team, once it was dispatched, it went dark, couldn't be called off. He said it was like a torpedo. Once you fire it at the enemy, you can't pull it back again. It just keeps going until it goes boom. That's what a senior official who was familiar with the conversation between the two, that's how they said it went down. Either way, the special operations team had the benefit of some of Ukraine's top special ops soldiers. One was a decorated colonel who previously served in Ukraine's main security and intelligence service. And get this, he was on trial in Ukraine for something unrelated. He was released on bail after over a year in detention after the alleged sabotage operation. So how weird or odd is that? The lead special ops person on the mission then serves time in Ukrainian jail. Strange. Blowing up the pipeline definitely helped Ukraine two ways. First, it loosened Russia's grip on the European countries like Germany that were supporting Ukraine. But the second way it helped is quite interesting. It left Russia with only one main avenue for shipping its natural gas to Europe, which are pipelines going across, of all places, the Ukraine. Yeah, most Americans don't realize this, but despite the war, Ukraine collects huge transit fees for Russian oil and gas, estimated to be worth hundreds of millions of dollars a year. So while each nation is shooting each other and blowing each other up in a war, they are also both making money off Europe's energy appetite. It's crazy, and it shows how vital energy is to everything, despite what might be going on around it. And back to the specifics of the operation itself. Like I said, this is James Bond or Mission Impossible stuff. The planners settled on using a small sailing boat and a team of six, a mix of seasoned active duty soldiers and civilians with maritime expertise, to blow up the pipeline. And those men and women rented a 50-foot leisure yacht called Andromeda in Germany's port town of Rostock. The boat was leased with the help of a Polish travel agency. That adds an interesting element. Poland, or at least a Polish entity, was involved. One crew member was a seasoned boat captain. Four members were experienced deep sea divers. The civilian members of the crew were also divers. So everybody sort of had diving expertise. I didn't realize this, but Ukraine has a long history of training top divers. A naval base on the Crimean Peninsula in the past trained deep sea divers for the purpose of sabotage and demining. Now here's a cool factoid. Ukraine kept combat dolphins that were trained to attack enemy divers and blow up ships. It's amazing. The base that I'm speaking of was taken over by Russia after it occupied Crimea, and its staff moved elsewhere in Ukraine, but of course their expertise remained and was allegedly used in this operation. Now, this was challenging. Four divers on the boat, they had to work in pairs in pitch dark, icy waters. They used a powerful explosive wire to a timer detonator or timer detonators. And since the Nord Stream pipeline was high pressure, you only need actually a small amount of explosive to rip it open. It doesn't take much in that regard. Bad weather forced an unplanned stop in a Swedish port. Witnesses on other yachts there in that Swedish port, they noted that the Andromeda was the only boat with a small Ukrainian flag hoisted on its mast. Now that's gutsy bordering on stupid. The attack took out three of the four conduits forming the pipeline. As I said, energy prices surged right after the event. Germany and other nations, they scrambled to nationalize energy companies that handled Russian natural gas, but collapsed after the pipelines were destroyed. Again, a lot of economic havoc to deal with and manage after the explosion. And today, Germany is paying about $1 million a day alone to lease floating terminals for liquefied natural gas, or LNG, which only partly replaced the Russian gas flows channeled by Nord Stream. And of course, our administration has an LNG pause for new export facilities that could be replacing that Russian natural gas as we speak. Again, crazy is what you get when you let radical environmental ideology run energy policy. Anyway, the investigators, they did have one lucky break. In rushing to leave Germany, the sabotage crew neglected to wash the Andromeda, that yacht, and it allowed German detectives to find traces of explosives and fingerprints and DNA samples of the crew. And that's where much of the evidence that I spoke about came from. Investigators then analyzed all mobile phone traffic in the areas where the boat was located, trawling through thousands of connections to distill the relevant data. I mentioned Poland and a Polish entity that was involved. And Poland is an interesting case in this drama. Poland was one of the docking locations for the team's sailing journey during the operation. And Poland's handling of the investigation after the sabotage was intriguing. The Polish port was covered by extensive video surveillance. And despite a history of close cooperation between Warsaw and Berlin in police matters, Polish officials refused to hand over the footage of the port and later told the Germans that the footage had been routinely destroyed shortly after the Andromeda departed. Okay. Yes, that's the wild, the fascinating story as to what looks to have unfolded with the destruction of the Nord Stream pipeline. And I figured and thought that you constant listeners would enjoy that one. This international spy and cloak and dagger story, it's another example of how volatile our world is becoming. Ukraine and Russia at war creates a constant threat of escalation into global conflict. Then you've got China increasingly menacing Taiwan. That adds another powder keg to the mix. Iran and its proxies in the Mideast, they keep kicking up escalation as Israel defends itself. North Korea never wants to be forgotten, so it's always launching missiles into international waters or toward Japan and South Korea. Indeed, the globe hasn't been this volatile for some time, constant listeners. Geopolitics, they're flashing red. Worst of all, those nations I just listed, Russia and China for sure, Iran any day now, if not already, in North Korea, they are at or close to nuclear capabilities, which carries us into a connection discussing the United States and its nuclear war strategy. I think a change is needed quickly, and allow me to explain why. So I got thinking on this topic when I had a chance to review President Trump's and Elon Musk's interchange or interview on X. And at one point, Trump said that he'd like to build an Iron Dome for the United States. He said, "We need it because it just takes one maniac to start something." Those were the words that he used. So that's what President Trump's view was, and that got me thinking. Now, of course, Iron Dome references the system used by Israel, which is designed to intercept short-range rockets from places coming or entities firing them, whether it be Lebanon, Hamas, Hezbollah, Gaza, and of course, its proxies and supporters in the form of Iran. And we're lucky to not have to deal with the same threats as Israel does. But the idea of needing an Iron Dome raises an important related issue. Not how we shoot down rockets, but how do we defend against nuclear missiles? We need to build a nuclear missile defense system, constant listeners. And we really don't have one now. And it's because we continue to deploy a different strategy that was built for and frankly worked during a very different time for a different type of threat than what we have now. Decades ago, during the early years of the Cold War, we faced a choice between pursuing missile defense or nuclear deterrence. Policymakers chose the latter, nuclear deterrence, which is an approach that views a large enough nuclear arsenal would deter an adversary from striking first. Assured mutual annihilation, that would avoid the temptation for the Soviet Union back then to launch against us. And the approach is known as the Second Strike strategy. That's what some refer to it as. And historian Keith Payne called it the Great American Gamble. And it was sort of a calculated gamble. The theory assumes that our foes won't misjudge or misunderstand us. So there's a bit of speculation there. And it has worked. Again, no doubt about that when it comes to the Cold War. We prevailed. Now, thinking the logic through, deterring an attack relies on an adversary's lack of confidence in victory, as well as its concern, the adversary's concern, for its own civilians. Yet not all of our adversaries these days judge human life the same. Some, in fact, have great disdain for their own citizens' lives, looking at them only as a resource to apply in a war or campaign for something that they deem more important. Citizens, in some ways, are pawns on the game board that are cheap when it comes to more than one of our adversaries. Consider our chief adversary today, China. The communist state founder, Mao Zedong, he said that if half of the world perished in nuclear war, quote, it would not be that bad. The other half, this is again using Mao Zedong's words, the other half will still remain, but imperialism will be destroyed completely and there will just be socialism in the entire world, end quote. Yeah, that's the culture, legacy, and view of the leadership of our biggest and growing threat. I'm not sure nuclear deterrence and that approach will work as well today with China as it did historically with the USSR. Sorry to freak you out. Our nuclear deterrence second strike strategy, by the way, faces other problems in today's world. It used to be adversary, as in singular, with the USSR. But now it's adversaries, as in plural. We no longer have the luxury and the easier task of dealing with only one adversary with nuke capability. Today, we've got to deter at least two nuclear armed powers, Russia and China. And as I said, Iran any day now, and maybe even North Korea. That adds more complexity, more actors, more volatility, and yes, more risk. And the world has also assumed a more aggressive stance. Today, Russia and China have both abandoned containment, and they are much more aggressive and accepting of war. Case in point, of course, is Ukraine that we just covered. And a soon case in point, I believe, will be Taiwan. And maybe the biggest problem with the old approach of nuclear deterrence today sort of speaks to what I'll call the fiduciary duty or the primary obligation of our government. Now, most of you know I'm a libertarian, so I'm always going to sort of desire small government, minimal government. But even a libertarian like myself recognizes that one of the primary vital roles of government is to protect the citizens from foreign enemies and threats. Our nuclear strategy leaves Americans vulnerable to nuclear annihilation, and that is a dereliction of a primary duty of government. Now, you might be thinking Ronald Reagan while I'm talking about all this, because back in the day, he saw this issue in a visit to NORAD, which is the North American Aerospace Defense Command, in 1979. He questioned the commander as to what would happen if the Soviets launched a missile against an American city. And the commander's response was, by the time the officials of the city could be alerted that a nuclear bomb would hit them, there would be only 10 or 15 minutes left. We couldn't stop it. President Reagan heard that, took issue to it, and didn't like the fact that the nation was so helpless. It simply wasn't acceptable. So he said on a return trip from that visit, the only option a president would have would be to press the button or do nothing. They're both bad. So he saw the threat for what it was. And President Reagan's attempt to fix the problem, the quandary, it manifested in 1983 when he introduced, of course, the Strategic Defense Initiative, or SDI, Star Wars as it became known and labeled by the media. It's a system that would track, destroy nuclear missiles before they reach their targets, and Reagan intended to replace the second strike strategy of nuclear deterrence with one that made the protection of American citizens the top goal, the number one priority. Now, the Soviets feared that SDI would work, and it led to the USSR's eventual defeat. But unfortunately, policymakers, we abandoned the program not long after the Cold War had ended. So we sort of, through policymakers and decision-making, we dropped the ball. But the return of a geopolitically hot planet with multiple adversaries, it demands that we revisit this policy and technology. SDI would serve the same function today as it did decades ago, which is saving American lives, and at the end of the day, perhaps saving civilization. Nuclear deterrence to work, that's going to require mutual, rational thinking from both sides, not just us. And I don't think assuming our enemies will apply such thinking is a safe assumption these days. Pursuing a modern SDI by employing interceptors, that would strengthen America's hand to coerce those adversaries into submission and ultimately to call their bluffs. Climate change is not anything close to our biggest threat these days. Let's wake up and look around the map. And if you want more in-depth analysis on this issue of nuclear strategy, it is fascinating, at least to me, then you might want to check out the Yorktown Institute on the web for their recent policy assessment on the topic. It's really spot on. Yes, we need to remain vigilant all along the watchtower when it comes to nuclear threats. And since it's closing time, let's make a last call connection to All Along the Watchtower. September 18th marks the sad anniversary of the death of Jimi Hendrix. Died in London at age 27. Frankly, his cause of death was disturbing, choked to death on his own vomit after consuming massive amounts of barbiturates. One of the greatest extinguished. And you listen to some Hendrix if you can today. My favorite song, Voodoo Child, close second is Manic Depression. I like both those songs quite a bit. Is Jimi Hendrix the greatest rock guitarist ever? A lot of people say he is. In fact, most say that he is. I put him second, only behind Eddie Van Halen. And you can read about my top 10 rock guitarists of all time ranking and the rationale behind it on nickdeolias.com in the commentary archives. Till next week, avoid the purple haze of this crazy world and stay connected to that far middle.